Welcome to the Talent Smart Podcast. Our intention in each episode is to interview interesting and inspiring people who will offer their insights into their areas of expertise. We want to explore how technology and business can improve and enhance the world. We're always keen to hear from you and let us know what topics you'd like to hear us cover in future episodes. Also, if you'd like to take part, please let us know. We're always looking for interesting and inspiring people to interview. Speak soon. Philip, thank you for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you with us. I know I've always enjoyed our conversations, and I'm glad to be able to capture some of this in recording so that people can utilize and listen to it and find out more about you and how you can help them in their lives. So thank you for that. I guess I want to jump straight in. We're obviously all working differently over this last year. We've uncovered things about ourselves, some good, some bad, because you know we've been working alone or living alone, or we've been scared about pandemics and anxiety levels are high. I wanted to touch into today's world of work and an area that you're a real expert in this, which is what is it to be human in the world of work today? So if you could just give an overview of that, and then we can maybe dig in a little bit.
I think the whole notions of what it is to work and what it is to not work and how to be human within those two fields are being forced to merge. I think it was already in train before the pandemic. You had a lot of companies, trendy companies like Apple or Facebook, where the environment, the work environment, my father wouldn't have recognized, you know, bean bags and fuzzball and all the rest of it. And that can be dressing, you know, that can be window dressing. But I think it starts to point towards the direction of travel, which is that people are more and more wanting to be part of a family at work. And because of 24/7 communication anyway, email on my phone and being able to be accessible, that also brings up other difficulties as well. How do we maintain boundaries between work and play? But the whole structure of the way that we're now working, unless you're in manufacturing or agricultural, something like that, is being melded. And so I think it throws up issues of boundaries. How do we get some delineation between being in work mode and being in not work mode? But I think it also brings us towards a more philosophical thought. A great kind of Zen type teacher of mine said years ago, and it's a real difficult phrase to get your head around, work is love in action. Work is love in action. And at the time I thought, well, load of crap. So just to let you know that my cynic is always a good and alive and well, and it's a good challenger. But the more I sat with it, the more I intrinsically knew that there was something of value and of truth in that. So just break it down. Work is love in action. So we all know that people come to work to get our Maslow theory of needs met, basic stuff. You know, we've got to eat, we've got to provide food on the table, etc. But we also know that people come to work to feel what? To feel, well, that they make a difference. To feel satisfied, to feel as though they've contributed in some way, to be part of something. And I think that is, again, something in the last year or so has been amplified, that a lot of the things that can put up barriers between work being a pleasurable experience, a human experience, even things like the clothes we wear. You know, everyone's zooming in jogging bottoms or jammers and t-shirt top. And I did a board meeting, I'm a non-exec director of a couple of companies, and we had a board meeting with Enter Finance Company. And there we were around the board table virtually in our Zooms, or in t-shirts, all of us.
Right.
And so getting back to the question, the world of work is changing. Our attitudes is changing. Our technology and the ability to be available is changing. And so there's a lot of choices in that. And I think the choices will allow the world of work to become more humane as right. Well as more human.
And what do you mean by that? Just to dig in a little bit. I mean, obviously we know the word, what the word humane.
Absolutely. I think humane, if humane is to be more flexible, is to be more open, to be more vulnerable, to be more transparent, all words that would have been an anathema to managers and leaders even 10 years ago. I mean, when I started doing this kind of more emotionally intelligent work with leaders and managers, I've been a consultant for 30 years working in the corporate space. 30 years ago, you couldn't talk about emotions in the boardroom. You couldn't talk about emotional energy. So it's some kind of fruitcake. So a lot of the personal development work I'd done as a facilitator, both in America and in the UK, I had to really hone down that language for the corporate world because they couldn't hear it. And now it's almost come full circle. You know, you've got the royal family talking about mental health. You've got conversations about well-being and real, not just fluff, but captains of industry talking about their own mental state and how to go for walks in between Zoom meetings and how to take care of ourselves. And so all of those human things that were not so many years ago confined to being outside of work. I remember a director of a company 25 years ago said, well, why, I don't want all this kind of fluffy stuff. He said, when I come to work, I leave me on the seat of the car and then I put my armor on and I walk into the office. Well, thank goodness that's gone, and it's going more and more and more. And it's incremental. The whole notion of flexi working and remote working has been accelerated. Mm-hmm. And through that, yes, we need to ensure, coming back to the humane part, that people do understand boundaries. They do understand how to turn push email, for instance, off their phones, how to close down certain applications. So going from the esoteric and work is love in action down to the practical, which is kind of the hallmark of techniques for living. How do I turn those big subjects of work is love in action? If love is being human and understanding myself and reaching out to other people and applying that to work being satisfying and delivering stuff that we all feel good about, and if we do it well, we'll probably make a profit in the process, so lose sight of that. But it comes down to practical things that we can do. And it might be to do with ensuring people, particularly at the moment, do have breaks in between Zoom calls. Don't book them back to back. Go for a walk in between. I went for a run before this Zoom recording.
Right.
Because I knew it would get my endorphins up. And it's ensuring that the world of work, which is now manifested itself so it can be so flexible. We can work in the middle of the night if we want to. But I think that also is incumbent upon us all to make sure that we take care of each other, to ensure that we don't overdo it and know when to stop.
And that's a key area, I think, that we need to explore, both, you know, those of the people who manage and the people who are being managed.
Yeah.
The people who are being managed potentially to push back a little bit more, because there is a tendency, I have heard a number of cases now, because obviously being in recruitment, you ask people whether they want to change jobs. And one of those areas is they are feeling, I'm going to use the word oppressed, I'm not sure it's the right one, but they're certainly feeling the pressure down on them to be available all the time. And that you talk about the separation between work and home, inviting people into your home, obviously it's become, I think, well, certainly I can speak from a personal perspective, I felt very, very vulnerable. And that's where I kept putting screens at the back and all that. You know, I mean, like there's false ones where as soon as you put your head back, you disappear. Now I'm quite happy for people to see the environment. I mean,
this is a real screen, by the way.
That's a real screen. I know it is. Yeah. But what I meant is we're protecting ourselves. And if one of the kids came into the room, it was almost like, you know, you'd go on mute, turn your camera off and get really angry. You know, where now I just think it's just become part of life. And people are looking into my world and looking into my home. So
absolutely. And so I think being more conscious, being more mindful. I mean, a lot of my work is based in mindfulness, but it's not just to do with the meditational aspect of mindfulness. If you think about the word, to be mindful, to be conscious, to be aware.
Yeah.
And it's also to be aware of our impact on other people and to be aware of what's going on, particularly on the inside with people. So one of the practical things that I've been working with individuals and company clients in the last few months is to start Zoom calls with a 2-minute check-in. And it could be just a 1 minute per person. And the rules of the game are you've got a minute to say how you're feeling. And I'm fine isn't acceptable. But it's also difficult because many people find it hard just to hear, particularly if it's emotionally uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And one of our knee-jerk reactions can want to go in and comfort or fix, which is human and empathetic. but sometimes it can close the person talking down. So what I've introduced in Zoom meetings, you know, this is another practical technique, if you like, is at the beginning of every Zoom meeting, and I get it on the agenda, 5 minutes, if there's five people in the meeting, to check in. And you have a minute to say how you are right now, warts and all. And you moderate how much emotional disclosure you want to put forward. So, you know, it's not something that you have to do. But what I've found, Phil, is that because people's emotions are far more to the surface now in these last 12 months.
Oh, definitely.
And I hope it will never go back. I think when the fear and the anxiety is gone, the habit pattern that I think has been formed by a lot of people to disclose, to emotionally say what's going on for them, be it in these little snippets at the beginning of meetings or not, I hope that will stay. Because at the heart of being human in the world of work is to build relationships. And I play with that word, you know, rather than a relation dinghy or a relation rowboat, using that analogy, a ship, you know, it takes a long time to build a physical ship, you know, rivets and metal and all that sort of. And it can take us through storms. It can take us on long journeys, a ship. And if you build a relationship, it's a vehicle, it's a ship within which we can relate.
Right.
And a lot of managers and leaders don't always drop the penny between the relationships in their personal life. And if you manage somebody, you've got a relationship with them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And simple things like a company I've just been working with, we've overhauled their appraisal system. I don't think I've ever talked to any manager in the 30 years I've been doing this when I say, what do you think of appraisals? And they usually come back with two comments, really important and never got time to do it.
Yeah.
So what I've done in several companies is started a discussion within the management and leadership and the people as well. What is the purpose of an appraisal? What are we appraising? And what we usually get to is, bottom line, we're appraising our relationship. That ship within which we relate, within which we do stuff for each other, for which we can become accountable for doing stuff. The accountability mechanism of salary is one mechanism, but it's not the most important. The most important is, I'm doing what I'm doing for you, Phil, because you're my boss and I like you and I get on with you. I might not even like you, but I respect you. And so rather than, you know, taking it to a personal relationship, if you had an annual appraisal or even four quarterly appraisals with your wife, you never really got
I dread to think, stop there.
You never really got to have a formal kind of update as, you know, how are we doing in between those four? I mean, your marriage would be pretty tested, I thought. And yet we think that so what I do is help people understand that a relationship in a personal way is not that different to a relationship at work. Every relationship has a purpose. And in a personal relationship, it has a purpose we can talk about another time. But in a work relationship, you've got a purpose, got an outcome. And if a manager can have a one-to-one catch-up once a week, could be 10 minutes, could be really simple. And I usually suggest three key questions. The first question is, how are you? I mean, how are you? How's your emotions right now? How's your week been? Yeah. And it'd be two-way. And just get that kind of out of the way. But it's like, oh, I feel terrible because, you know, my two-year-old didn't sleep last night and I feel shit. Oh, great. Okay. So it could be from that to, yeah, I watched a really good movie last night. And generally, my life's all right. I feel a bit guilty because everyone else is having a tough time, but I'm doing all right. So it's whatever that is. But again, it just reconnects the relationship. The second question is, and how have your objectives and things that we talked about last time been since last time? Are you online? Are you in track? And then the last question is, and how does the next week look like? Anything I need to know about? And you can cover those three questions within a relationship that's fairly well oiled. 10 minutes?
Yeah.
And doing that once a week, once every 2 weeks max, negates the need for a formal appraisal. And all I'd suggest is that you have a version of that 10-minute conversation once a month that is slightly longer, and you make a few notes of it. And you do that 12 times a year, and those 12 notes is the thing that you look at in the round when it comes to salary review.
And
in terms of this
more human approach, and I really like it, by the way, but I also want to touch on the fact that I know you've got great examples. I'm not going to ask you to name names of companies, right, but the economics of this play out as well. So whilst everyone's happier, of course, and you know, we all feel more connected in the method that you teach, I know, in Techniques for Living, I think it's important to also touch on the fact for the audience that there's also economic benefit to this as well. There's practical business benefit to this. So I just wanted you, if you could touch on that a little bit as well. You don't have to give examples of companies. I don't need name names to anything.
Well, I'm happy to. There's a couple of the companies I can name because I've got permission to name. So two, one is kind of current, although I worked with them a while ago, is Pfizer, the drug company, which is obviously more famous now for the vaccination.
Yeah.
But I worked with them about 20 years ago on a failed angina drug. And they wanted us to get that drug to market more quickly. And they gave us this failed angina drug because the consultancy I piggybacked with, they were a process change consultancy. I was the culture guy.
Yeah.
And they tried to enforce process change on a very high profile drug. And Pfizer said, whoa, hang on, you're putting a lot of people's backs up. We're going to take you off that high profile drug and we'll give you one we don't think is very important. And this angina drug turned out to be Viagra. but our approach to bringing about the change in the process, and we did get Viagra to market 9 months ahead of schedule, and we achieved it by invigorating the kind of relationships that, and it comes back to relationships again, between the different silos in the organization. Yeah. So statisticians very much worked on their own. Biometrics, who made sense of all the data, very much worked on their own. The clinologist that set up the phase 1, 2, 3 trials always worked on their own. Marketing, forget marketing. I mean, we gave phase 3 data that Viagra worked to marketing and then said, right, you can take it to market now. They said, we should have needed 2 years. We need to name it. It was called sildenafil at that point. We need to come up with the shape of the tablet and the color. And so all of that, all of the resistance that was being shown when they purely worked on process, we started to devolve or disintegrate by getting, it sounds really simple, but by getting people to talk to each other and have sessions where they could talk about their problems and their issues and why they've not worked with their department well before because that department doesn't understand me. And even then we came down to talking to the architects that were building a new office block on campus in Sandridge and Kent and got them to change the layout of 2 floors so we could have some open plan space so they could continue to talk with each other. So all of that turned into, started with relationships, then started to talk about physical configuration of office space, then started to talk about improved process, and then we got it to market 9 months ahead of schedule. And when you think about Viagra at its height, was making Pfizer $1 million a day.
Right.
Is the highest grossing invention of man. It's in the Guinness Book of Records. So talking about, does this approach translate into profit? Yeah, hell yeah. And I think a lot of, so I often describe my work as being a mixture of software and hardware.
All right.
And you can relate this to corporations, as I've just done with Pfizer. Another example would be Ella's Kitchen, the baby food company, where we did a 4-year project to help them maintain their values whilst they were growing at 120% year on year.
Wow.
And that was almost the other way around. There was a very strong family feel, very strong values, everyone mucking in. But they had no processes, no systems, no structure. No real strategy other than we're growing so fast, let's keep going. And at that point, 2 of the directors were under medical notice for potential nervous breakdown.
Oh my God.
So a lot of companies try and decouple the software, the human aspect, attitudes, values, skill sets, behaviors, from process, systems, strategy, structure. And it's impossible. And if I take it right down to the individual, and Techniques for Living is aimed at individuals, be they humans on their own or humans at work, because again, that distinction doesn't really work for me anymore. If I work on my own, but one of the things I do is I meditate. So I've learned to meditate over the last 18 years or more. But if I can't apply the stillness I get from meditation to the way I run a meeting, that's hardware, that's structure, then the software of feeling calm and me feeling good, if I can't communicate that through a system or through a process, or even engineer a conversation within a company so that we can change process, or if I'm in a home setting, you know, if I'm feeling calm and I'm feeling on top of my own emotional well-being, but I can't get that across to my partner, so we end up having an argument. Because it comes down to the process of, well, we said we'd redecorate the bedroom, but we can't agree on the colors, you know. So,
yeah.
But often human interaction will always break down into the attitudinal and the skill set. And unless we can get a combination of both, one of the things I find can be challenging about some of the meditation apps that are out there, which by themselves I think fantastic, you know, Headspace, Calm, some of those, is that they don't always have a linkage to, so how do I apply that being in the present to conflict resolution, setting a context with people, to giving difficult feedback, to hearing difficult feedback, you know, all the mechanics of interpersonal communication. So in the Techniques for Living, we're breaking down the courses when they're finished, and they're not being recorded yet, but they'll be in three main categories. And under the short headings of me, you, and us. So the me section will be on understanding me, managing my own emotions, managing my own thoughts. And this applies as much to being human at work as any other setting. And if I can start to manage me, then it goes into the next one, which is you, which is interpersonal communication. So there's personal management, and then there's interpersonal management. And the last one is us, relationships. How do I maintain that ship in which we relate?
Yes.
Be it my girlfriend, be it my son, be it my colleague at work, be it any kind of relationship. And it is always the interplay of skill sets and attitudinal stuff with practical communication skills often that we can practice and learn and pass on.
And I love the fact that, you know, the relationships and the segmented, and especially in a, you know, a disparate workforce as we are at the moment, everyone remote, and the responsibility of us all to be kind and caring to each other, and actually take that time, you know, to ask genuinely, how are you? Not the, how are you? I'm grand. Let's move on. Within that, then, the one area I just want to explore a little bit with you, sure, is our own personal responsibility for mind management in the home working space.
Yeah.
How could we and should we take more responsibility? I mean, we're going to touch on resilience in the next episode, but just in terms of mind management, so I'm going to take personal responsibility for my own mental well-being as best as I can. Now, it's we've all got different you know, availability for achieving that. What's your sort of thoughts on that, about the personal responsibility for mind management and care of oneself?
Well, it's potentially a crass statement, but I think one that we need to remind ourselves of, which is, I can only be the master of my own salvation.
Right.
Sounds a bit highfalutin, but I can only take care of me ultimately. So you're talking about self-responsibility. And looking again at that word and taking it apart, how can I increase my ability to respond?
Yeah.
My response ability. And I think if I, when I decouple that word and remind myself, so How can I increase my ability today, Philip? And I'm talking to this Philip here to respond. Well, to start with, I can sit still. The various forms of meditation, don't even have to call it meditation, but carving out a space, and it may be 2 or 3 times a day, where you sit still, you turn all the machines and things off that can interrupt you, and you notice your breathing, and you close your eyes, and you just sit still, noticing your breathing for 5 minutes. Set your timer on your phone. Do it for 5 minutes, do it for 10 minutes. Notice your thoughts. A lot of people think that the purpose of meditation is to create a clear mind. I don't know how to do that.
No, I agree.
Most long-term meditators would tell you that that isn't the purpose. It's more to notice the mind and notice the thoughts, and notice we have choice as to whether we listen to the thoughts or not. And also through that 10 minutes of sitting quiet and still, notice every time I do have a thought, you may start to notice your breathing might change. Every time you have a thought, your heart rate may change.
Right.
Musculature, you know, you think of a happy thought, your musculature changes. It may soften very, very subtly. You think of an anxious thought, you tense up.
Yeah.
So one of the things that 10 minutes can do is to remind ourselves of something that Buddhists call the mind-body phenomena. And in the Pali, which is the ancient Indian language that the Buddha would have spoken, they don't write it as mind, body, phenomena. There's one word. So mind, body is written as one word. And in the English translations, it's mind dash body. And what they're trying to convey is that we talk about 5 senses, taste, touch, hearing,
smell.
Hearing, touch, taste.
And smell.
Smell, that's right. But there's a 6th sense, because if whenever I see something, it shoots a little bit of adrenaline around my body. It's a fight or flight mechanism. Even if it's a joyous thing, if we hear something, smell something, touch something. But when I think of something, also my mind shoots a bit of adrenaline around the body. And we have 20 to 50,000 thoughts a day. So the amount of influence our thoughts have on our mind. So going back to tips, having 10 minutes where you can settle your mind and settle your body with it can have a huge influence. And just get into that as a habit. And you doing it once a week won't do anything. It's like going for a walk once a week. It's getting into a habit of doing it once a day at least, perhaps a couple of times a day. Then you other ideas that can help working from home, mentioned some of them earlier. Go out of the front door before you start work.
Right.
But literally, even if I've got not much time, I'll go outside the front door, take a few breaths in, or I might walk to the end of the drive, or I might walk into town, depending on how much time I've got. But I was as a discipline, I will not go from the kitchen to my office without going outside.
And what does that do? I think it's a great idea, by the way.
On several levels, I think mentally it can draw a line between this is home and this is work.
Brilliant.
Even though we talked about the delineation breaking down, I think boundaries can also take a place. No matter how much I feel as though my work is love in action, you know, it takes a certain amount of concentration to do this call as if I was doing my run this morning. So they are different. Yeah. So I think having some kind of physical delineation between one space in the home and another space in the home, physically, and also mental space. And also going outside brings oxygen into the body and can reinvigorate it. And I do the same in between meetings, between Zoom calls. I think Zoom calls for a lot of people can be tiring. I hear a lot of people say that if they've had Zoom calls all day back to back, they're pretty knackered at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And I think there's several reasons in that. The amount of concentration in a Zoom call is greater than if you're in a physical meeting room, you've got cups of coffee and people have a break and blah, blah, blah. So to compensate for that, I think see if you can book your meetings with at least a 15-minute break in between.
I think there's also this tendency that I'm seeing and witnessing, and being part of myself as well, is this tendency to work longer hours, and the workday is creeping into family time, which, of course, you know, I'm not saying that people shouldn't do that, but there's also, if you're doing it consciously, I think there's something to be said for that. If all of a sudden you're waking up, you're unconsciously doing it, then you may be affecting other people that you love and care for without meaning to.
Absolutely. I think that establishment of boundaries between work and not work was already an important area before the pandemic, but it was quite slightly less obvious because you could do an extra hour's work at the office, for instance, before you came home, if you were conscious enough to do that. But of course now you can't, because you are at home. So the effect on other people is an important one. But I think also for, again, our own well-being, to be clear about setting our own boundaries, so our own responsibility, setting time frames within which I'm going to work and not work.
Yeah.
And again, on a practical level, years ago I merged my day book with my diary. So although I have an electronic calendar like everyone else, I still have a paper day to a page. And the reason that I do that is that anything I want to do, any task I want to do, even from buying stamps to picking up the dry cleaning to a coaching call with the CEO, rather than put it in my day book, I put it in on the day I intend to do it.
Right.
And so by the time I get to the evening of the day about to arrive, I look at the next day's list as it's evolved over the previous weeks, and often it's too full.
Yeah.
So rather than try and do it all, I take out all the stuff that isn't as important, and I leave myself all the tasks that I know I should do tomorrow, but I also know I can do. And it's a great discipline I've found for ensuring that at the end of the day, everything on that list has got a line through it, which in my mind means done it, as opposed to a wiggly line through it, which means didn't have enough time, moved it to another day.
Yes.
And I think it's very good, again, for our well-being, to set ourselves tasks that are achievable and achieved. And I think that's true in all aspects of life. Have a stretch goal if you want to, but there's a limit. And I think a small, greater self-discipline has been called upon in this pandemic. I think the other thing that's happened, I've spoken to a lot of sales managers and sales directors in particular, and they seem to be a breed that were more reticent to trust their team on Zoom without having a BDI on them. And one of them, I checked in at the beginning of lockdown, and she said, "Oh, I don't trust my team, and I wish I could go into the office and have them in front of me." Anyway, I checked in with her a couple of months later, said, "Oh, how's the team going?" And she said, "Well, I'm amazed." She said, "The targets have gone up." So that's interesting. What do you reckon that down to? She said, "Well, it's almost as though they're trying to prove themselves to me without me kind of being on their backs." I went, "Oh, that's interesting."
Yeah.
And then she said, "The more I'm starting to trust them, the more they're trusting me, and the more they want to repay that trust by doing more." So I'm actually now starting to have calls with them where, okay, she's taken on board what I suggested, and she's having that check-in regularly with them, and she's saying, "How are you doing? You know, do a bit less. If you look really tired at the moment, how's your kids? How's your..." And so it's not affecting the economic output, it's actually increased it, but it's also taken that dialogue into a much more human area. So I think maintaining boundaries, setting yourself work-life segments in your diary or your workbook, having two or three times a day where you're just quiet and still.
Yes.
You can breathe and listen to your body. And I think also that helps us listen to each other more.
Well, that's been absolutely fascinating, Philip. I'm looking forward to talking to you in our next episode, but I'm certainly going to take away the visual, because I'm a visual person, of relationship, and have that that ship in my mind whenever I'm engaging with people, to think that's a vessel we must travel together in and make sure we stay connected. So thank you so much for this episode. I look forward to talking to you in the next episode. We'll talk more about self-reliance and building resilience. And we'll speak again soon. Thank you, Philip.
Thank you, Phil.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the Talent Smart podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. We're always keen to hear your feedback. Please let us know your thoughts and what episodes and what topics you'd like to hear us cover in the future. Our intention in each episode is to interview interesting and inspiring people who offer their insights into their areas of expertise. We're keen to hear from you. Please let us know your thoughts and if you'd like to take part in future episodes.